Welcome to LP Collage, Michael. How are you tonight?
I'm great. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Of course, our pleasure. So when did you first become interested in theater and performing and singing?
It's been lifelong. I don't remember a time that I was not performing in some way. I remember being in kindergarten and doing our Christmas musical. It's just always been there.
Nice,
But
nice.
I think there was, it was, but where it sort of changed to this other animal where it was like, this is what I have to do for the rest of my life. It was actually seeing a production of Annie at American Musical Theater San Jose when I was in fourth grade, starring Joanne Worley as Miss Hand-Me-Down.
Oh,
And once you see and hear that on stage, you can't help but say, I want to do that for the rest of my life.
wow. Well, we'll have to explain who Joanne Worley is to some of our younger listeners. She was sort of like a Hollywood Squares type celebrity who had this long sort of, God, decades long career, right? Who a lot of people probably didn't even realize that she sang much.
And she had that laugh. Well, she still does. She's still with us.
Is she
She's
still
still
with us? Oh my goodness.
with
Bless her heart. She's probably older than the Queen.
us.
So when did you first get on stage? Do you remember that?
When it became a real thing, we had actually left the area. I grew up mostly in Castro Valley, but my mother had remarried and we moved to Stockton. And I went to a great high school in Stockton for a few years, and they had a summer theater program. And incidentally, the first production I did with them was Annie. But that gave me this understanding of like what was involved with theater, putting all of the elements together and having to actually get in and do the work to put costumes together and props and set and other aspects of production, along with the performance part.
Nice. I remember from my high school experience that we used to do four shows a year, and I think, wow, the budget of a public school, public high school, I can't even imagine what the budget was, to put on four shows a year. Maybe a little different now that students have to do a lot of fundraising for such extracurricular activities. So were there any teachers who really inspired you when you were coming up?
While I was in high school in Stockton, had a wonderful musical director and for our choral program. And he was actually, I had an interest in music education and was sort of grooming me to follow that path and would take me to music reading sessions with other choral directors. And he'd give me, menial tasks like making a catalog of recordings of things. But then that just helped me to develop that deeper knowledge. And then I had another, I was in middle school in Castro Valley, then Stockton, and then I came back to Castro Valley for my senior year of high school. And I had the same choral director as I had in middle school. And she was really amazing and was really there for me, along with our drama teacher. Not the most exciting shows that year. I think we did Oklahoma and Our Town as our teacher was retiring. And she wanted to do her two favorite shows. But they were very instrumental in me embracing this path and myself. And I was very fortunate.
Nice. So talk about your higher educational background.
So I went on what I like to call the grand tour of higher education. I had still planned on pursuing music education. That was what I was being steered toward because everybody thought I'm going to want security. I'm going to want this job security, and I'm not going to want to live out of a suitcase. Put me in a classroom, and I'll be happy for the rest of my life. And then I found a voice teacher. It was about a year after I graduated from high school. And her name is Pamela Hicks, and she was in Hayward, but she actually is now in Sebastopol. And we talk about it still to this day, 31 years later, that something just happened. 6 weeks after studying, and all of a sudden I was singing my first Italian aria, and all of a sudden the path starts veering away from music education and taking me into performance.
Wow.
And then, so, but from there I studied at, I went to Las Positas College in Livermore for a couple of years, and then, goodness, I went on to University of the Pacific for a short time, and then I transferred to Westminster Choir College in Princeton, New Jersey, where I stayed first semester. And then I moved on to, then I realized that's just too much choral singing, so I need to move on from that. So I ended up at Boston Conservatory, and I had a wonderful teacher there named Elizabeth Finney. And then what was great about that program is the opera studio and the opera training of characterization, makeup, all of those things. Normally those are reserved for graduate level, but this was an undergraduate and graduate program. So I got all of this stuff like early on. And I had a wonderful directors, Cecilia Sheevy and Patricia Wyman, but Cecilia and I still talk, you know, every couple of weeks, just checking in. And it's nice to know that I have that support still, as I did when I was a student. Then I was itching to come back home, so I ended up at San Francisco Conservatory, where I had a wonderful teacher, and it's a teacher I still work with now named Sylvia Anderson, who's in San Rafael. And then at that point, it was like, okay, I think I've tried enough schools out. It's just time to go and sing. And so I left school and started singing and was doing quite well for myself, doing some local and regional opera work, really great concerts. I did a production of Madame Butterfly in the role of Sharpless with West Bay Opera and then Bayshore Lyric Opera in Capitola. And a legendary soprano named Licia Albanese was directing our Butterfly, and she has this foundation, and she and her son invited me to, they gave me a study grant and invited me to join the winner's concert, which took me to Alice Tully Hall in New York City, where I'm singing to this packed house of 1600 people in New York. And there's huge, huge stars, like just hanging out in the backstage. It was phenomenal. It's phenomenal. And I kept on that path until about 2004. And then I stopped singing for the better part of about 10 years.
Mm, wow.
And that was actually after the loss of my grandmother, who had been really instrumental throughout every aspect of my life. And I had to figure things out. And now looking back, it was a tough time. I mean, I went from singing full time to looking at a 10-year period, 2004 to 2014, maybe cramming it all together, about 3.5 months of singing. Mm. And that included my time on television singing. But I did go back to school in 2014 to finish my degree, finally. Had to go to a private university because my units were too old. State schools wouldn't accept them.
Oh, wicked.
So I ended up at Notre Dame de Namur University in Belmont, and I finished my undergraduate degree, BFA in musical performance, and I added this minor in religious studies, and I decided to stay there for my master's degree and earn my MFA, also musical performance. And the majority of my work there was focused on the integration of the expressive arts and social justice issues. The main piece, capstone project for my degree was a lecture recital I created called Queer Liberation Theology, an Exploration of LGBTQ+ Oppression Through Song.
Amazing. All right. I want more details about that for sure.
When I ended up at Notre Dame, I assumed it was going to be wrought with Catholic fire and brimstone coming at me at every direction. And in turn, what I ended up with was this experience of understanding the difference between religion, theology, and spirituality. And the courses that I took for my minor were religion and ecology and Islamic studies and women's religious studies. And it was religion and film. And that sort of set this path for me to end up in this liberation theology class. And it was really funny. The professor, I could not stand him for the first 5 weeks of the class. And of course, now he's like this great friend and mentor. And he would just walk by me and drop a little pamphlet, a little reading on the table where I was sitting. And they were these readings about queer theology, feminist theology. And it just got my brain thinking. And I worked throughout my master's degree, the first year of it, to develop this piece. In fact, what was really exciting is I didn't just go automatically to like any piece that was just solely gay and lesbian type of content. I went through about 500 different songs just looking at the lyrics, focusing on areas of oppression within our community and finding texts that represented that story. So there's about, I think, 9 different genres of music that are represented, from hymns to contemporary theater, contemporary opera, art songs, you name it, it's in there. And out of all of the things I've done in my life, it is the one thing I'm the most proud of.
Oh, that's amazing.
Because it allowed me to not only really perform in an authentic way, but it was about, this is what I believe, this is who I am. And it's very well received. I've done it throughout the Bay Area, I think 8 or 9 times. Mm. And then I did excerpts of it in Europe in 2018.
Wow. So you took it on the road.
Yeah.
And what was the response? Like what type of venues were you doing the lecture recital?
So there were the neat thing about the piece and what took a lot of work. First of all, normally you would expect with a lecture recital, you're going to talk about something and here's the piece of music that demonstrates it. And that's not how I crafted it. It's actually almost completely underscored with music from start to finish. And I've woven what I talk about through parts of songs. So it's this continuous flow. I've done it at churches. I did one for a Rotary Club in Scotland. And the interesting thing for me about the piece was that I always saw it as a living piece. I expected it was going to change. Now, originally, the first presentation was in 2016, right before the election.
Mm.
And then I had to do it again in 2017. And here I thought I was going to be able to, you know, change pieces. There would be this evolution of the piece, like, but in a positive way. And every time I had to perform it and present it for the next year and a half, it seemed, I was having to talk about how things were being taken away from us.
Mm.
And it was nice all of a sudden that I got to put the positive spin back on it and like that, this like personal growth. And so the response has been really great. Some of the things that I was touched by, I talk about, talk about Harvey Milk. And I met a woman who was an assistant in his office. And another woman, when I'm talking about Gilbert Baker and the flag, she was one of the people that was in the room where tearing apart strips of fabric. So it took these things that, you know, there's this real historical information, there's anecdotal things that I've learned along the way. And then to have somebody there to substantiate that, and it was the most important thing to me is that it starts conversation somewhere.
Mm.
And that's exactly what it did. And that's the cool part, to just have a group of people all of a sudden just gathering and talking about the piece.
Amazing. Is there a place we can see this? Have you recorded it?
I have some things recorded. I'm actually reworking it because I want it to now evolve out of an academic piece and more of a performance piece.
Wow.
So where there's a lot of talking of content. I also put a lot of work into the visual pieces to it. So I want to now sort of change the focus to some of that and maybe have program notes that people can look at and follow along. But I'm hoping to get some new clips up soon that will be up to date and relevant. And
It sounds fascinating, and I'd love to see it. I'm sure many of our audience members would love to see it. So how do you see the representation of queer lives in theater transforming both our community and the manner in which our community is viewed?
You know, it's always a weird sort of thought to me, because it's what I've grown up in. I know not everyone has had an easy time as I have had. In fact, I actually, at 48 years old, just encountered my very first incidence of homophobia directed towards me. And it was when I was trying to get a dog.
Oh my goodness.
And I was told that the dog I wanted, they wouldn't let me have it because they were placing it with a family. It's easy to take for granted some of these things. And I forget the power that this art has. And I'm finding new things about it even now, about how it can, you know, foster new ideas and communication with people. I was actually just speaking with their title is intimacy director for our show. And when I was focused just on opera singing up until about 2004, it was, in the classical world, it was very straight. So I remember when I went and did this concert, it was the Lincoln Center one, a gentleman who was a part of the foundation pulled myself and two other gentlemen aside and gave us this sort of speech lecture about how when we get to the New York Athletic Club for the dinner, that we need to remember that we are representing, you know, this art form, and we need to be sure we're presenting our very best selves. And it was basically like, you know, throw yourself back in the closet. And then what amazed me is now, I guess it will be 2018 or 19 when they did it, but First Street Opera, which is a small grassroots company in San Jose, I've done a couple concerts with them, but they actually have these great Pride Series concerts where you are the opera singers doing gender bending and singing different arias and things like that. And, you know, 20 years ago, you do that and you're just not going to work. And so seeing that this art has this continuous like life to it and can transform the communities around us. But I will be honest, I have sometimes struggled within our community to find my place. But I'm grateful that I've had my art and my voice to express myself so that I'm able to make connections with people within our community.
So for two seasons, you were a serious contender on America's Got Talent. What did you take away from that experience, personally and professionally?
That, of course, there's nothing real about reality television. You know, when I first went on, I saw an ad on Craigslist saying they were looking for singers. And so I sent this email that was ridiculous saying, my name is Michael. I'm an American. I've got talent. And I included a recording that had been made of me on a phone If Ever I Would Leave You from Camelot at a karaoke bar late one night in Sunnyvale. And that was what I sent. And then I was shocked that with like a week later, I have a casting producer contacting me and then a segment producer. And they, next thing I know, I'm on my way to LA. And I was just taking in every moment of it. Like it was just really, really cool. When I was eliminated, season two, I made it to the top 35. I thought, wow, that's amazing. I mean, at the time, I think there were some 700,000 people that auditioned. And I'm like, if I made it in the top 35, that's not a bad deal. And, you know, they have psychologists following you around after you've been eliminated. So before they allow you to leave the holding area. And I kept saying to the guy, I said, listen, sometimes you get the gig, sometimes you don't. Like, it's just that simple. And it was a really bizarre experience to me. It got even stranger once the show started to air. I remember coming home from work early and I just threw the TV on, went to go get some water. And I'm like, hey, what is that I'm hearing? I'm like, oh my gosh, that's me. And I go running out. And like, here I was a commercial after like during Days of Our Lives. And It was, you know, it was still a difficult time in terms of this, you know, the loss of my grandmother and the grief journey I had been on. So I watch that now, and what I see is just, I know how sad I was on the inside. What's also different to when you go back and look is I've lost considerable weight since then. I've lost over 400 pounds since I was on the program. So I don't look like that person anymore either. And to go on to season three, which I hadn't expected, I thought it was done. And this time to make it into the top 25 was phenomenal, especially out of like over a million people that auditioned. Though if you ask Alexa who Michael Strelow Smith is, you will hear Michael Strelow Smith was a contestant on America's Got Talent season three and came in 23 place. So I guess I placed 23rd out of, you know, one plus million people. So again, can't complain about it. Can't complain.
Excellent. That's amazing. Wow, we're having such a great conversation. We're going to take a little break here and do some fundraising for KRCB, but we'll be right back with Michael in a few and talk about his upcoming role as the MC in Sixth Street Playhouse's run of Cabaret. All right. Welcome back, Michael. Thank you for that little break there. So how are you approaching the role of the MC in Cabaret?
What's been important to me since the opportunity came up was that it doesn't resemble something that exists. I wanted to have my point of view. And, you know, touching on, and it's also important with the role for me, the role was never on my radar ever in my life. And that's because prior to the major weight loss, the reality is I wouldn't have been cast in the role. But this is this sort of turning point for me where I'm really getting to, you know, put all of the best parts of myself into this role and grow with it. I like to say in the work I've done is if agape, this like intense, inexplicable love, and Schadenfreude, like, had a baby. That's how I see the MC. Everybody loves him. They want to love him, but nobody really understands just how sinister he is. And I mean, I'm going to have to burn my journals when I'm done with this. It's some dark stuff I came up with.
Wow. So, because you don't really get his most of his personal life or his backstory in the show. So you went about creating that backstory and gave him an inner life, let's say.
Yeah, and then more as I started working with it, I thought, now is this some character I'm creating, or am I having to identify some really dark places in my own life? But
yes, to both.
I'll leave that there.
That's amazing. I know our audience members may be more familiar with the film version starring Liza Minnelli and Joel Grey as the MC. Are you familiar with that performance? Were you able to glean something from that performance and bring it to your interpretation of the MC?
You know, I look at these iconic representations of the MC done by Joel Grey and also by Alan Cumming, and it's, for me, I felt the best way to honor those performances was to let them be as they are and allow myself to explore new things with the role. And a lot of it has to come down to my perception about how we treat text as a performer. I can't say something the way Alan Cumming did or the way Joel Grey does, because I don't have their experience that led them to deliver those lines that way. I think to just sort of mimic that takes away from their work and selling myself short. So I always say, at least this way, if I fall flat on my face, it's my own fault.
Yeah. Your own darn fault, right?
Yeah.
So talk about the rehearsal process. I mean, I could imagine it's physically challenging show to perform.
Yeah, and it's a much harder role than I think lets on, because you know, you have these two different stories going on. You have the what's going on in the cabaret and then the separate storyline outside of that, and trying to find the pacing of it to where there's a sense of continuity for myself. And that I'm helping this create this connective through line of the show, but then and seeing how my interpretation works into it. And it's been, it's exhausting. It's just flat out exhausting. But it's that good kind of exhausting though.
Nice. So talk a bit about your talented co-stars and your director, Jared Sacrin.
All wonderful people to work with. You know, I was approached about the role based on a video audition I did for Theater Bay Area for their generals, and that's how they found me. And so I didn't come in through the audition process, the regular audition process, to get to know the cast or meet with them. So it's been exciting to watch their development with the storyline, the characters. And what's great is there is quality performances that are coming from my fellow actors and the experience that they bring to the table. Some of them are very new in the process of performing. These roles are like big leaps for them. And then there are seasoned performers who everybody gets a chance to learn from. But then again, if you just stop and watch what's going around, you're always going to learn something from anybody you're sharing the stage with.
Nice. So this is your first.
And you know, of course, the work with the director has been wonderful. And I also have to point out our choreographer, who is just fantastic. And I've spent a lot of time with her dealing with, you know, the movement numbers with the Kit Kat Club, boys and girls, which is what it feels like, because all of a sudden I'm standing around looking and I realize, oh my gosh, I'm the oldest person in this room, like by like 20 years. It's terrifying. But it's been this wonderful safe place to explore this role. And that's exciting.
Nice. So this will be your first performance at Sixth Street.
Yeah, and it's really funny. I have not done a role for 5 years. And I've been looking, you know, doing some auditioning down in the South Bay where I live. But I was trying to figure out, why is it all of a sudden that the one job I get that's great, how did I end up in Santa Rosa? And it just seemed crazy. And then I realized, you know, my time that I spent with my grandfather here as a child, twice a year, you know, spending time with him, it was such a wonderful experience. It was a safe place for me. So it makes sense that I get to come to this safe place to do a role that's pretty scary to me. So
Right.
And it's also been a wonderful company to just be a part of. I really admire the management of the company and just the overall work ethic and respect for each other and for the work that we're doing. It shines through in every aspect of production.
We're so grateful. We have such an amazing theater. Sixth Street is Playhouse is just such an asset to our community.
And I'm not just saying these nice things because there's great air conditioning here. But it's true.
That's another ticket selling point, right?
Yes, absolutely.
I've heard tickets are going fast, so get yours soon.
Yes.
I was just sort of on the site and I was looking at some dates. I mean, I already have my tickets, but I thought, wow, you know, they are really going quickly. So it's going to be a fabulous show. What relevance is this show in this point in our history? I think you know what I'm getting at. We're experiencing sort of political turmoil, you know, right and wrong, good and evil. It's almost biblical as our democracy, you know, it has to fight to maintain itself. And of course, the maybe you could explain the show for people who aren't familiar. I can't imagine there are many, but it takes place just as Hitler is taking power, and this amazing city is sort of, this liberal city is sort of coming under attack quickly.
Yes, and I the two words that constantly pop up for me are complacency and how complicit we are in it. And the one thing that just keeps coming back to me, especially if we run the piece and whatnot, is, wow, we don't learn. We just can't seem to learn from these mistakes that we've made. Because it's just really horrible, horrible things throughout history that we should have learned from. And, you know, it's, I think the theme that resonates with me the most now is, you know, if we are not standing up for each other at all times, you know, who's going to stand up for us when it's our turn? And it's so easy to just turn away, hoping things are going to be okay. It would be nice if we didn't have to keep approaching that cycle over and over again. Mm. And I think that this show, you know, written and first, you know, produced in the 1960s, about 1929, 1930 Berlin, tells just as much of our story today as it did prior to that.
Yeah. And theater does that. Last season, Sixth Street presented Hair, which I went to see, and it was this incredible production. And I was thinking that same thing, you know, when I was discussing with the folks I went with. And this was just sort of as the war was starting in Ukraine, right? And I'm like, anti-war, you know, anti-war. We're still saying, using these same terms. We're still having these same feelings. We're still striving to move beyond these things that we can't seem to.
No, and I think that there is obviously great power in theater and arts in general, because you know, it's there not just to entertain. I mean, the entertainment part of it is great because that nurtures parts of ourselves and our soul. But really great work is the kind that sparks conversation and provocative thought about what's going on in our world, because that's how things change. I think that's what I was so struck by as a student at Notre Dame de Namur, was this mission and commitment to social justice. And I realized how the arts influences that. Because if you can go back and look at every social justice movement in our modern age, and there's always a connection to some form of expressive arts, like the two have to work together. And it's great when it's like the right formula. And this is one of those shows where I think that you get this great expressive art representation about real issues of social justice, not just of the past, not a historical thing, but just about our current time. And what are we going to do in the future? Are we going to allow this to happen again?
So are you familiar with also the text on which Cabaret is based, Christopher Isherwood's novella?
Yeah, it's something I've not read, but I know bits about it.
It's very different. So you know, you've got this interpretation. I've never seen Cabaret on the stage. You know, I wish I had. But I have friends who saw it, who did see it on Broadway, and said it was just amazing. It was such the incredible experience. I know they used to do it sort of cafe style. So it was a really, you know, the Kit Kat Club, there was the stage, and you know, the audience was almost part of the show, which I know they're not doing at Sixth Street, but, how are you bringing that sense of, involvement to the audience in this production?
Well, right now in rehearsals, I would say that just about all of the empty chairs are totally there with me. They are just so involved. It's going to be exciting to actually do it in front of an audience and continue to, as we get through this last chunk of rehearsals, to see how I can engage with people. And that's where a lot of the pressure is too. I'm the one that is breaking the wall and that is you know, I have my co-stars on the stage, the people that I'm working with, but that's what the audience is as well. Like that interaction has to be authentic in order for, I think, the show to really work. And it's scary.
It's scary, challenging stuff, but rewarding, we hope.
Absolutely.
For everyone.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Excellent. So what do you have lined up when Cabaret ends its run?
Oh, most likely lots of napping.
a break.
I will. Yes. So right now I'm working. I decided, because I had all this free time, I've gone back for a second master's degree. So I'm back at Notre Dame de Namur in Belmont in the clinical psychology program. I'm not working towards licensure. It's just to add to the work that I do as a private voice teacher and creativity consultant, just to have a little bit more depth knowledge about how creativity really works for all of us. So I have that, and then I am getting the kick in the behind to finally get my one-man cabaret show together that I've been working on. In fact, it's been made clear to me that there happens to be a venue, and I'm sitting in the building right now and will be for a cabaret to hopefully bring that show here.
Wow.
And, you know, just seeing where the next thing goes. you know, this was an unexpected opportunity. So I'm hoping many more of those.
Very good. Well, Michael, thank you so much for joining us this evening, and best of luck. Break a leg if we're still saying that, and we'll see you there on stage as the MC.
Yes, please do. come to the cabaret.
Very good. Of course. Great, Michael. Good night.
Good night.